Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This week joining us, Hans Hassel, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Cornell College. Hello, Hans.
Hello.
And Jim McCormick in our Ames studio, Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Great to have you on board as well, Jim. Thank you.
Thank you, Ben.
And we always love to have our listeners join in on our Politics Wednesdays. Of course, a number of issues, half dozen, eight or so issues. We'll try to march through, get analysis from Jim and Hans today. But of course, please offer your observations, your questions on any of them. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Later in the program, we'll talk about the proposed budget by the president. Also, that coupled with the recent tax cut, we'll sort of ask the question, especially for our conservative voters listening, have Republicans given up on their longtime goal of eliminating the budget deficit? Talk about that a little bit later in the hour. Also, developments in the Russia probe as well. And we heard some testimony from our national intelligence, the director of national intelligence, among others, talking about Russia meddling in our next election coming up in just a few months in 2018. Let's start off with some of the updated news on ongoing scandals here. Let's talk about Rob Porter. It's been about a week since the first reports emerged about this alleged domestic abuse by the White House staff secretary, Rob Porter, someone who works very closely on a daily basis with the president. Porter denies the allegations. He did resign soon after they were made, though. And this departure story continues to develop. It's unclear, Jim, it's unclear about his security. He had an interim security clearance. The FBI saying now, the FBI director, Christopher Wray, saying now that the Bureau completed its background investigation of Porter last year, contradicting the White House's assertion that the FBI process was ongoing. So that's why he was still serving in the White House?
Yeah, it's very puzzling how he, first of all, got the position and then how he stayed on for so long. If all of this kind of documentary evidence is really support what the FBI says, I don't know how he originally got the position and certainly how he stayed on for so long. I mean, it must be just simply a lapse in the White House, and you know, everything has been pointing to the chief of staff. It really falls to John Kelly there. So I'm really very puzzled, and I noticed on your newscast that you had a comment from Trey Gowdy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that in fact as Gowdy likes to talk about, the fact patterns do not support the president and the executive office on this at all.
Mm-hmm. Your thoughts, Hans, about this? Does it tell us perhaps something more about operations in this White House?
I think it's part of a larger pattern, which I think is concerning. Right, there's the ancient story of I think it was a famous rock group that it would always include a kind of a minor detail in their contract to make sure that the people that they were working with included that followed their contract. This was the Brown M&Ms, so they had to have a stash of M&Ms. Where they only wanted the brown ones, and this was their way of checking as to whether or not the people were kind of doing all of the other things that they should be doing that they had to do in order for the concert to go off well. And I think that this is, you know, this is kind of evidence that there's something wrong with this White House in terms of the way that it's governed and the way that it's run and the smoothness of the operations. And if we're seeing things like this, which are important. There are obviously other things that we should expect, and we've seen that throughout the last year and a little bit of, you know, repeated failings or things that the administration should take care of and should line up and should be kind of routine mm-hmm. processes for the administration. And this is just kind of another one of those very clear failings where somebody didn't do their job and they haven't been doing it well, and now you have this, and now you have this scandal again.
Right. Jim, perhaps you can explain for those to whom it is not crystal clear, we have alleged domestic abuse, two former wives of Rob Porter. Why should that affect a security clearance? Why do we worry about that when we have someone like that serving the president, working closely with the president with these alleged charges?
Well, he would be subject to blackmail. Is sort of the immediate thing that you would think about, that somebody could use him as a conduit to get to the president and to blackmail, in this case, Porter, in terms of maybe some documents. He would have access to lots of highly classified documents, and you know, not having a top secret security clearance, you know, is really puzzling to me. And this would be obviously the avenue that those that knew about these past experiences could use to blackmail him.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting here that in Mara Liasson's reporting on this, that she says the president has been remarkably silent about the core issue in this scandal. When we talk about domestic abuse, he tweeted, without mentioning Porter by name, how horrible it is that people's lives are being shattered and destroyed by mere allegation. Is there no such thing any longer as due process, tweeted the president here. Well, Hans, your reaction to how the president has handled this? It's interesting also in Mara Liasson's reporting, unlike other scandals swirling around the White House, the president isn't blaming the deep state for Porter's demise. He's not going after the FBI. He's not even attacking Democrats, is he?
Yeah, I think that's right. What's very interesting to me is you look at the individuals that the president tends to believe in, the individuals who the president doesn't seem to believe in, and there seems to be a pattern there. In terms of who his preferences are for, and who is his right. If there's an unsubstantiated rumor, who is he likely? Is he likely to believe that rumor? And the context in which that rumor is propagated kind of drives what he believes. And so in this case, he's not believing the allegations against his former staffer. In the case of the Obama birth certificate, he did. The Central Park Five, right? All of these sorts of things. There's a clear pattern in terms
We have to mention Roy Moore here.
Yes, exactly. Roy Moore as well, right? So you know, it's a very clear pattern in terms of who the president trusts and who the president is likely to believe, even in the absence of evidence.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like to me it's a larger issue too. I'm really puzzled that these individuals working in the White House would not really very quickly get sort of a check on their for their security clearance and so on. And this seems to me is kind of the larger failing here, if we could point to that.
Mm-hmm. Will there be any consequences for the president? This one of many scandals developing here, Hans, do you think?
Well, I mean, I think that the biggest thing is that this is another hit on the ability of the president to work with Congress. I mean, I think this lowers trust. This lowers right the negotiating pieces that the president has at their disposal and the executive office has at their disposal and puts them in a significantly weaker position relative to Congress. And so, I think for the president's ambitions and policy goals that he might have. Right. This is a detriment to his ability to extract that policy and to persuade Congress to embrace what he would prefer to be the set of priorities. And this, I think, this ultimately puts them more beholden to Congress. And right now maybe that's not a big deal, right? Because he's got a Republican Congress. But this becomes very problematic if in November Democrats are able to take over the House or even the Senate.
Mm-hmm. If you just joined us, Hans Hassel with us of Cornell College, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, Politics Wednesday. Join our discussion, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Before we get on to the proposed budget by the president, also that immigration debate that started yesterday, the infrastructure plan by the president and so forth. One other thing that we have the latest development of, the Stormy Daniels story. Yesterday, the president's personal attorney said he paid $130,000 out of his own pocket to a porn actress, Stormy Daniels is the name she goes by, who allegedly had a sexual relationship with Donald Trump in 2006. Michael Cohen said in a statement to the New York Times he was not reimbursed by the Trump Organization or the Trump campaign for the payment to Stormy Daniels, her real name, Stephanie Clifford. So this is interesting. The president has denied this affair, and unless you think we dwell on the Stormy Daniels affair on this program, this is, to my knowledge, the first time we have mentioned it on Politics Wednesday, even though it has been going on for weeks. It's simply been crowded about by the crowd of things that are happening in politics as of late. So, Jim, when you think about this, Donald Trump has denied the affair. When we put that together with Michael Cohen's saying, you know, he paid $130,000 out of his own pocket, we have more questions than answers, don't we?
Yeah, it really doesn't pass the smell test, does it?
I mean,
you know, in terms of, you know, what, you know, this has been, as Michael Cohen's been his attorney for, I guess, decades, Trump's personal attorney for decades, and out of the goodness of his heart to get this off the shelf, he comes up with, I think it was $125,000 or something. That's not really walking around money, it seems to me. That's quite a bit of investment. So it's very puzzling at the very least.
Hans, has Michael Cohen offered also why he paid $130,000? Nearly $130,000. Whatever the figure is, it's a ton of money. Hans, your thoughts on how this is?
One of the most interesting things about that I saw this is that when he was explaining why he paid this money, it was to facilitate. I paid this money so that this would go away, but I paid this money facilitating a negotiation between. So his statement almost leaves open that there's some other kind of motivation involved here, and that there is more information than what we're actually seeing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's move on and talk about the budget proposed by the president on Monday. It's one that calls for cuts in domestic spending, social programs such as Medicare. It also seeks a sharp increase in military spending. The funding for the wall on the Mexican border is there. Jim, comment on the budget. Is this a budget that Donald Trump's base would be happy with? And we have to remember, too, it's Congress that controls the purse strings to purse strings. So this is just a wish list, the sort of a little symbolic wish list that the president puts forward.
Well, and I think certainly on the military side, you know, increasing military spending is something that Trump supporters would be very happy with. And, you know, I suspect that's going to be the real thing that he's going to drive in terms of this budget. Because remember when they passed last Friday sort of the ceiling on spending for the next 2 years, they also included a great deal of money for social welfare programs. I mean, the split was $165 billion for 2 years for the military and $131 billion increase on the social welfare side. So I think what we're going to see is kind of the in terms of the appropriation process going forward, and those ceilings are just sort of authorizations. They are not actual spending dollars, and so we're going to see, I think, the president put a great push on sort of the military side and sort of the cuts on the social welfare side that are also outlined is going to be. Going to be a priority. But I think there's going to be the bargaining that's going to be struck, given that they have those ceilings in the authorization package.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the national debt and the budget deficit here. That has come into view because this budget, coupled with the tax cut, doesn't seem to walk the talk that Republicans have, at least during the Obama administration, been more than happy to put out there. Let's go to a flashback, April 2016, and this was certainly not the only time. This was a standard part of Donald Trump's stump speech campaigning on the promise he would work to decrease the national debt. He gave an interview to the Washington Post saying he could eliminate the national debt over a period of 8 years, in fact. Well, here he is at a campaign rally in Wisconsin from April 2nd of 2016.
And we better get rid of the debt, and we better straighten ourselves out, because we have debt on debt on debt. And one of the things, we're going to talk about a few of those things, because it affects you very much, and I know you have a lot of small business owners here, probably a couple of big business owners here, but we have to get rid of it.
Okay, the president in 2016. Hans, given what we've seen here, budgetary-wise, is this something that Trump is going to lose favor with among his base, conservatives, who say you've got to be financially conservative here and responsible?
Well, I mean, I think that you're seeing a very different, you are seeing a very different Republican Party, and I think we knew that when Trump won the nomination, I think that the president has a strong ability to shape the party, and it's very clear that Trump has a different view on debt. I think that if you look at that quote that you just played, there's also quotes where Trump says, I'm king of debt, right? I've made a fortune out of it by using debt, and if things don't work out, I can renegotiate the debt, right? And so he has all these quotes about debt, and debt not necessarily being a bad thing, but he's also has this idea that, I mean, so I think that's more lip service than to his actual governing way of governance. So I think that there's something, and I think that you definitely do see a change in the Republican Party, and it's undoubtedly that Trump as president has changed the view of Republicans and changed what it means to be a Republican.
Well, I've heard too the idea that actually it hasn't changed. Hans, take on this claim that I've heard from is that Republicans will are happy to speak against deficit spending as long as they are not in power, and this has been a consistent theme. Is that something that you see as well?
I mean, I think that could be true, but I don't think we've had such a brazen example of putting forward this deficit and also not even using the same rhetoric, right? I think in the past when they've done that, they've used the rhetoric of supply side economics that by reducing taxes, even if we increase spending, we will bring in more revenue on the whole because the economy is going to do better. And so I think this is kind of the first obvious time where that rhetoric has disappeared as well. And you don't see that same, right? When you heard Mulcahy talking about the budget, he's not talking about it in terms of being a deficit hawk. And I think that's what's changed, is that the rhetoric surrounding the budget has changed in this iteration of what Trump is presenting to Congress.
Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Reggie is with us in Oskaloosa. I see, Reggie, you want to have a comment or a question about the budgetary situation we're talking about.
Yeah, one thing that when the CBO scores a tax cut, they use static scoring instead of dynamic scoring, which means there can be no increase in the stock market, in home values, in anything. Everything stays exactly the same, which is not the way the economy works. If they use dynamic scoring, which is the proper way, every income tax in the last 100 cut in the last 100 years has caused an increase in revenue to the national government. Mm-hmm. Last month was the first time in almost 20 years the U.S. Treasury said they ran a surplus of $49 billion. That's the first time they've run a surplus in almost 20 years.
So it sounds like, Reggie, you don't have any problem with there not being any rhetoric and the fact that this there's a lot of red ink in this budget.
Well, see, the red ink is you're using static scoring, which doesn't work.
Okay. Okay. Let's get a okay. You made that point. Let's get a response to that, Reggie in Oskaloosa. Thanks for the prompt there, Jim. Do you have an idea here? Static versus dynamic.
Well, I think
the
assumption here is that there's going to be this kind of growth in the economy, and by all estimates that the Trump administration has been using, is that they have had taken very optimistic assumptions about the amount of growth that's going to occur in the budget, and whether that will really come true or not. I mean, I take the point about dynamic scoring versus static scoring here, but there are lots of other variables that I think the caller might want to consider as well.
Okay, let's listen to Rand Paul talking on CBS's Face the Nation. He certainly takes it serious. Over the weekend, the Kentucky Republican called a number of members of his party hypocritical for passing both tax cuts and spending increases.
I think if you're for tax cuts and for increasing spending, that's hypocritical. But if you're for tax cuts and you're also for cutting spending a corresponding amount, see, I would offset the tax cuts with spending cuts. And there are a few of us that would actually do that. When we had the budget deal that lowered the taxes, I also had an amendment to look at and try to control entitlement spending at the same time to pay for the tax cuts.
Okay, Rand Paul there. Characterize what you hear there, Hans. Rand Paul, certainly not in the center of the Republican Party, often an outsider, and he held up this latest budget agreement, didn't he?
Yeah, I think Rand Paul is perhaps the most clear kind of example of an ideologue who, you know, has some sort of a set of principles that very clearly constrain his actions in some way. And so he may be an individual that's going to react the least to current events in a partisan way among those senators. Right, you look at individuals who kind of sever those the electoral ties and partisanship as well. And so I would also look to individuals like Bob Corker and Jeff Flake, if you want to get a sense as to how the Republican Party might be shifting in some ways. But I think that in essence, you've got this tension. And I think Rand Paul is a good example of the tension of the rhetoric. Are you talking about a set of principles and ideological principles, or are you talking about actually hitting the road and what they're going to do and try to win majorities?
Okay.
I wonder if we should add one thing here. I mean, there's a 2018 election coming up, and part of this whole budget thing about spending and cutting and so on, it's going into an election cycle. It's very, very tough for politicians to make claims about great amount of cuts here. And I think that also is playing partly into these kind of budget proposals here. Any kind of concern about making cuts for the future.
Okay, very good. We'll be back after a short break. Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, Hans Hassel of Cornell College. Yes, we do have a midterm election coming up. We'll talk about how leaders of U.S. intelligence agencies warn that Russia will try to interfere with our elections once again, using social media, spreading propaganda, misleading reports, much as they did in the 2016 campaign. We'll talk about what the U.S. intelligence leaders, said when we come back. Also, the infrastructure plan that the president has put forward, a couple points of Iowa politics as well to fit in. Hans Hassel, Jim McCormick with us. I'm Ben Kiefer, back with more of River to River Politics Wednesday in just a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
We're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's a Politics Wednesday edition. Tomorrow on this program, my conversation with former Iowa governor, now U.S. ambassador to China, Terry Branstad. I'll be having a conversation to be recorded a little bit later today. Right now, it's the middle of the night in Beijing, so we're going to wait for daybreak to occur in China. Then I'll be talking with now U.S. ambassador to China, Terry Branstad. That will air tomorrow. That's the plan tomorrow on this program. Jim McCormick with us of Iowa State University, Hans Hassel of Cornell College. Jim, Hans, here's your chance to chip in a suggest a question for my conversation with Terry Branstad later today. Hans?
I would wonder what the transition is from going from an executive to a subordinate.
Okay, great minds think alike. That is definitely on my list. An interesting change of roles after being an executive for so many years here in Iowa. Well, Jim, your thoughts?
What is kind of the diplomatic initiatives that Ambassador Branstad is taking with regard to the South China Sea issue. Mm-hmm. That has been sort of in the background with all of the North Korea discussion. So I would be very interested to know about that. And as it segues into our discussion about the threat environment, I also would be interested in knowing to what extent the 2015 agreement between the United States and China over over cyber attacks has really been effective, or what changes does Ambassador Branstad think we need here?
Great, great suggestions, Jim and Hans. Let's go back to our politics here. Yesterday, before the Senate Intelligence Committee, the Director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats, briefed officials about the threat of cyber meddling in U.S. elections. He spoke not just about Russia, but also named China, North Korea, and Iran. Let's hear a little excerpt of what the Director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats, said yesterday.
Frankly, the United States is under attack. Under attack by entities that are using cyber to penetrate virtually every major action that takes place in the United States. From U.S. businesses to the federal government to state and local governments, the United States is threatened by cyber attacks every day. While Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea pose the greatest cyber threats, other nation states, terrorist organizations, transnational criminal organizations, and ever more technically capable groups and individuals use cyber operations to achieve strategic and malign objectives. Some of these actors, including Russia, are likely to pursue even more aggressive cyber attacks with the intent of degrading our democratic values and weakening our alliances. Persistent and disruptive cyber operations will continue against the United States and our European allies, using elections as opportunities to undermine democracy, sow discord, and undermine our values.
Okay, there they were, the leaders of the U.S. intelligence agencies testifying yesterday. Jim, what was your takeaway from that testimony?
Well, it was really frightening, it seems to me. I took the liberty to print out the worldwide threat assessment that accompanied the Director of National Intelligence remarks. And one of the sentences that struck me early on in it says, a risk of interstate conflict, including among great powers, is higher than at any time since the end of the Cold War. So it was a very frightening kind of statement. And what was the other thing that struck me was that the highest priority was this cyber threat. Much of the other kind of statements in this threat assessment was really consistent with another report that came out last month, the National Security Strategy Statement. But what Director Coates did was to put the cyber threat at the very top of the agenda, and I think that's a very, very important kind of consideration to, for our discussion.
Participating in that intelligence testimony of the U.S. intelligence agencies, Senator Angus King was part of that. Here's one of the comments that I found interesting that he made. Angus King, an independent from Maine, voicing concern at the Senate Intelligence Committee hearing yesterday. He called on President Trump to acknowledge that the meddling that is verified by all of our intelligence agencies, no question about it, he wants the president to acknowledge it isn't a hoax.
My problem is I talk to people in Maine who say the whole thing is a witch hunt and it's a hoax because the president told me. I just wish you all could persuade the president as a matter of national security to separate these two issues. The collusion issue is over here, unresolved. We'll get to the bottom of that. We cannot confront this threat, which is a serious one, with a whole of government response when the leader of the government continues to deny that it exists.
Hans Hassel, comment on that. That is, we have this huge new threat coming from abroad, and then we have a president who denies believing his own intelligence agencies. This complicates it, to say the least.
Yeah, and I think part of this is that this is a complicated issue. That when we talk about meddling, what does that mean? Is that the integrity of the vote? Is that collusion between the president and foreign agents? Is that investment into advertising and trying to persuade voters to change their opinions? Is that sowing discord through extreme rhetoric? I mean, each of those things has an effect on the election, but I think that all of the actors involved would say that they have a different effect, and that some of those are more serious than others. And I think what's happened is that the average American public isn't paying enough attention to really distinguish between what's going on. And so when the president says there's no collusion, we as an American people aren't paying close enough attention to realize that he's talking about collusion and not necessarily investment in advertisement to try to affect the outcomes, or extreme rhetoric that or fake news or other sorts of things that get thrown out there. And I think that's the key, is that there's one thing that President Trump has a strong incentive to deny, which is collusion. But by denying that, he also makes it appear that some of these other things, which are serious, but maybe not as bad politically for him, may actually have occurred.
Mm-hmm. Jim McCormick, do you see it that way?
Yeah, I think Senator King's question is really the appropriate one. I think the president really does have to acknowledge, I mean, here's his entire intelligence community. There's 17 different agencies that have come together in terms of identifying this very serious threat and an action that has been taken. My sense is, and this, I think, goes along with President Trump's style here, if he gives any kind of trek to the idea that there was this kind of Russian interference, it somehow, as Hans was saying, goes over to suggesting that there was collusion. And I think what you really have to do is sort of differentiate, as Hans was saying, between these two. And that's what the president is reluctant to do, because by saying one, he seems to think he'll give kind of support to the other kind of charge. And as Senator King said, let the investigation conclude on whether there was collusion or not. But the reality of this kind of serious kind of threat across a whole set of elections here, and not just in the U.S., they've been, Russia's been involved in France and so on, and I suspect elsewhere, that this has to be rebutted.
Mm-hmm. And I think this is a kind of nuance that's hard for politicians to state, right? This is something that the public's not going to pick up very clearly, and so that this is a kind of thing that a politician has to be very careful about how they frame this and how they talk about this. One thing that I think is hopeful, though, is that I think that public officials, at the lower levels at the state level, do realize the importance of ballot integrity. And there has been a fair amount of investment from each of the individual states, which are really responsible for the integrity of the ballot. And they've been taking some serious steps to try to shore up any perceived weaknesses or any vulnerabilities that might be there. And it seems as though at least that they're taking steps in the right direction to make sure that at least the integrity of the vote won't be challenged.
It's kind of interesting. There's great irony here, because many states are now moving back towards paper ballots as a way not only to guard against kind of any kind of intrusion by the cyber world, but also as a way to make certain that they can really do a recount if that is necessary, or a factual count as is necessary.
Final 10 minutes with our political analysts this week, Jim McCormick and Hans Hassel. And let's go to a caller, Don in Des Moines, dialed 1-866-780-9100. Don, you want to talk about Russia and its meddling, I believe?
Yes, Congress has passed a expanded sanctions on Russia, which President Trump has chosen not to enforce. How can the president not enforce legislation passed by Congress?
There's a question. Jim, what do you think about
that? That's an interesting thing, because, in fact, in August of 2017, the president did sign that legislation that would have put additional sanctions on Russia and some Russian officials here. And at the same time, he issued this really stinging signing statement saying that he was not going to do anything that interfered with his authority, his executive authority as president. So that's part of the handle, I suspect, that the caller is referring to in terms of not carrying it out. Now, it does also say in that legislation that if President Trump would lift some sanctions on Russia, the Congress has written into the law that they would have the right to try to intercede to stop that action by the president. I'm not sure that that's constitutional, and we don't want to get too far in the weeds here, but it's something called the legislative veto, which the court, at least back in the 1980s, has held as unconstitutional. But it is an interesting effort by the Congress to safeguard the president from taking too much unilateral action.
Yeah, this is exactly kind of what the founders envisioned, was is you have a check on these checks and balances within our system, right? The Congress passes the law, but it's the executive branch that implements those and is in charge for interpreting right, how those should be implemented. And then you've got a judicial branch that oversees whether or not that is in line with what the legislature's intent was.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the immigration debate, that much anticipated debate started yesterday in the Senate. This, remember, was the one promised as part of a spending agreement. Yesterday, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell gave senators just 1 week to find a solution for the so-called Dreamers. These are the immigrants who were brought into the country as children, have never lived anywhere except the U.S., and also to find a bipartisan solution on DACA and addressing border security. He urged lawmakers not to let the opportunity to start a debate go to waste.
Yesterday, the Senate took an initial step toward considering proposals to address DACA, border security, and other immigration issues. This week's debate comes as no surprise to my colleagues. For a month now, I've repeatedly stated my intention to bring these issues to the Senate floor following a government funding agreement. Senators have had plenty of time to prepare. There's no reason why we should not reach a bipartisan solution this week. But to do this, we need to get the debate started, look past making political points, and focus on actually making law. Making law will take 60 votes in the Senate, a majority in the House, and a presidential signature.
Okay, McConnell listing off those three requirements. Hans, is that likely to happen from what you see here? The Democrats getting their debate, is it going to go further than that or just kind of spinning wheels?
It's really hard to see what's going to happen here. One of the things I noticed this morning is that Trump has endorsed the bill that Senator Grassley has put forward as the solution. But I think that's I'm not sure that bill is satisfactory to Democrats in addressing some of their concerns, and I think it's hard to see something that's going to be able to pass both the House and the Senate. You may be able to see some sort of compromise bill pass the Senate, but it's going to be very hard to see whether that's going to be able to placate and satisfy some of the hardline immigration folks in the House.
Mm-hmm. And the president insisting on his four pillars. Remember, these mentioned in his State of the Union address, the four pillars being the path to citizenship for the Dreamers over a 12-year period, I think it was stipulated in that address, a secure border. He's very attached still to this border wall. And also ending the visa lottery without merit or skill considerations, on ending what he would call chain migration. Others call it family-based immigration. Your thoughts on the future of comprehensive immigration legislation, Jim?
Well, I think some of those are going to have to be dropped by the administration if they hope to get a bill passed in the Congress. I think particularly the sort of the chain migration element there. And, in terms of the new budget, as I understand it, the administration has actually requested $12.5 billion for the wall. So, I mean, I suppose they could cut some of the funding. I don't think a bill can be passed without some funding for the wall. I can't imagine that the president would sign that. But I think it's possible on the chain immigration, because that has a clear humanitarian element, and maybe they'll kick the can down the road on the visa lottery issue that they would set up some kind of commission to look into it. I'm not confident that the March 5th deadline can be will be the end of this debate. But, you know, President Trump, even then, early on, said that he would extend beyond, although he seems to have backed away from that. I suspect as we get to crunch time on that, he may extend the debate out a little bit on the DACA. But I would see a couple of those things being jettisoned and maybe the focus being on the path to citizenship, the 12-year suggestion that you talked about, as well as some funding for the wall, and maybe continuing family reunification here.
With just a few minutes left, I'd like to get quickly to two other topics here. North Korea in a minute with you, Jim, but infrastructure. Let's talk about that, Hans. If you could give us your thoughts after the president rolled out his infrastructure plan, the White House wanting to use $200 billion in federal funding to encourage $1.5 trillion in improvements over 10 years. I guess the idea to rely on state and local governments and the private sector, also wanting to eliminate environmental hurdles to projects and a part of it as well, selling off federal assets. From what I'm reading, I don't know what you're reading, Hans, this has not been received that well.
Yeah, I mean, I think Democrats have criticized it as being a very small supplement or in terms of the amount of money dedicated to it. But I mean, I think in many ways what this is and there are many ways that government can go about doing something and accomplishing kind of policy or whatever it is that they want to accomplish. And one of those is that the national government can step right in and do it themselves. And I think what President Trump's plan is it's essentially a set of carrots, right? The carrots dangled in front of state and local governments to try to incentivize, repairing their roads and having local responsibility. And in many ways, that's a very typical Republican plan, which is, right, trying to minimize the role of the federal government and incentivize, participation at the local government. So because in the Republican view, right, local governments are much closer to the people and know perhaps much better what needs to be done. And so this is essentially a set of grants, a set of carrots dangled in front of state and local governments so that they can go and address some of the needs that they have and receive some kind of supplemental money from the federal government to go and accomplish those things.
Quickly to North Korea, also in that testimony, Dan Coats, the director of national intelligence, warned that time's running out for the U.S. to act on the threat posed by North Korea's nuclear weapons program. He said North Korea presents, in his words, a potentially existential threat to the U.S., and it's likely to conduct some more weapons tests this year. So what did you take away from that testimony specifically on North Korea, Jim?
Well, aside from what Coates said, the CIA director said we only have a few more months. He's been quoted as saying there's a few more months in terms of the actions of the North Koreans here. I guess I'm limited degree of optimism. The Secretary of State still talks about having negotiations, and certainly, the out of the Olympics and the efforts of South Korea to try to renew contacts with the North, maybe that can be used as a conduit for some discussions.
It was really interesting that the charm offensive we're seeing at the Olympics, the sister of
yes.
the North Korean leader presenting the South Korean president, Moon Jae-in, with a folder, a handwritten note from her brother.
Yes, an invitation to visit the North. I don't think that he's the president of South Korea, President Moon, has accepted that offer yet, but that certainly is a kind of an opening. I think that could be used. On the other side of it, the negotiating with the North, even when negotiations start, are always so problematic that that gives you considerable pause and sort of takes you back to the statement that the Director of National Intelligence said and what the CIA director said as well.
Okay. Thank you very much. Our hour has come to an end. Jim McCormick, Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Hans Hassel, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Cornell College. Jim and Hans, thank you so much for spending the hour with us and giving us your analysis.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Reminder again that tomorrow on this program, a conversation I'll be recording later today with now U.S. Ambassador to China, Terry Branstad. We'll discuss his role in representing U.S. interests, also in representing President Trump's policies in Beijing. The nuclear standoff with North Korea will certainly be one of the discussions I'll have with him. Also, on the personal side, we'll talk a little bit about how he and his wife have adapted to life in Beijing. He also has a daughter there, a son-in-law, and some grandchildren as well. So it should be an interesting conversation. I hope you'll join us for that. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Thanks for joining us.